From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Happy birthday, Sgt. Pepper. The Beatles' epic 1967 concept album turns 40 next week. It was like nothing the world had ever heard. Summer 1967, the summer of love, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. On the cover, the Beatles in day-glow faux military regalia standing graveside with the multitude of cutouts, Marilyn Monroe, Karl Marx, Aldous Huxley, and many more. Inside, a big psychedelic vinyl album that blew open the popular culture's doors of perception, or at least it felt that way. This hour On Point, listening back to the Beatles' grand experiment, Sgt. Pepper at 40. You can join the conversation. Were you there with Sgt. Pepper? What did it mean? What did it feel like? And for new listeners or old, how does it sound today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We have a great crew with us to listen back this hour. From New York, Anthony DeCurtis, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He interviewed Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr for the magazine's 40th anniversary issue, out now. He's author of In Other Words, Artists Talk About Life and Other Matters. Anthony DeCurtis, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
In Washington, Tim Page joins us, Pulitzer Prize-winning chief music critic for The Washington Post. Tim, wonderful to have you.
Good to be here, Tom.
And with me in the studio, Tim Riley, author of Tell Me Why, The Beatles, Album by Album, Song by Song, The 60s and After. He's editor of the online Riley Rock Index and is working on a biography of John Lennon. Tim Riley, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
Tim Page in Washington, take us back to that moment. It was June 1st in the UK, June 2nd in the United States, 1967. This album hits the music store stands when we still had such a thing, and what did it mean?
Well, you know, what I remember about it was a time of real simultaneity of interests between lots and lots of different people. You went to the record store, and you saw kids, you saw grown-ups, you saw professors, you saw students, all with Sgt. Pepper in their hands, waiting to pay for it up at the counter. It was the moment, in some ways, when rock really became respectable. All of a sudden, you had this vast sort of symphonic album out there, and suddenly classical musicians felt that they could write about it. You had such books as Wilfred Miller's Twilight of the Gods, and you had professors who'd play it at their parties, where they probably wouldn't have played some of the earlier works or much other pop music, and of course kids loved it too. It's hard to separate the feeling of the music from that era too. It was a very exciting time in music. Leonard Bernstein had just done a big show about the rock revolution. There were all these new words in the air like psychedelic, yeah. And it was just a very interesting time, and it was a real cultural icon.
Interesting, to say the least. Anthony DeCurtis, for people who, you know, were not even conceived in those days or conceived of, how do you communicate the scale of this as a cultural event? What does it compare to? Is there something, anything now?
Well, you know, what's kind of interesting is that in a certain sense these days, I mean, we have something like Sgt. Pepper, like, you know, every 20 minutes or so. I mean, there's a kind of scale of immediate penetration, you know, with the internet and everything else, 24-hour news cycles, all the things that we've become accustomed to. But back then, it was very rare for anything to have the kind of immediate impact of Sgt. Pepper. You know, there was a sense in which it suddenly was everywhere. You know, you went to a club, yeah, they were playing it in the club. You went to your friend's house, your friend was playing it. You know, you went into, you know, go buy a shirt, you go into the shop, they're playing it. The scale of it was something certainly I had never really experienced before. You know, except for maybe, you know, something like the Kennedy assassination. You know, there was, everyone knew about it instantaneously. It seemed like first it wasn't there, then it was everywhere. And it felt very important, you know, and there was that element it was precisely the thing that Tim Page was just talking about was true, certainly. I mean, it crossed a lot of boundaries. But it also became kind of a little bit a dividing line. It meant, you know, are you taking drugs? You know, that was important. It was a kind of generational statement. Do you get it? You know, which side of this line are you on? You know, and it was that kind of thing as well. The artistic ambition led it into certain communities, but there was also a kind of sense of this is an album for us, and the messages are for us, and it really seemed to signal, well, it sounds so quaint now, but, you know, some kind of utopian future.
A kind of cultural tsunami with all kinds of promise there. All these songs, which are now deep in the culture, you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Fixing a Hole, When I'm 64, Lovely Rita, Within You, right on down, She's Leaving Home. I want to think about and talk about where the Beatles were, what was going on with this, because it was a big transition for them as well. But let's get a little bit of that sound. We want to keep it in our ears in this hour. Here's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, June 1967.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green, towering over your head. Look for the girl with the sun in her eyes, and she's gone.
And there it is, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, L.S.D., Tim Riley. You know, suddenly it's tangerine trees and marmalade skies, and it seemed like 5 minutes before these guys were singing, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. I know that's not exactly true. There was a lot in between, but what was going on with the Beatles in 1967 when this album came out? This was a whole new Beatles.
Right. Well, there's a major shift in the musical sensibility that you have touched on. It's absolutely right. And the larger shift that's happening here is that the Beatles are moving from making dance music into making music that is specifically designed to be listened to. And part of the reason for this is that they had their tour of 1966, which was such a disaster in so many ways, the bigger than Christ quote that they had to deal with and getting kicked out of the
Philippines. We're bigger than Christ, and boom, off the anger went.
And so they went back into the studio, which is really where they preferred to do their work and where they kind of felt they were going to do their best work. And they played the expectations game really well. They worked on this record for 6 months in the studio.
Dropped off the touring circuit for the first time.
Dropped off the touring circuit and emerged with an argument, which is, why should we ever tour again? This is an album that's not meant to be recreated live. And nobody, even listening to the record today, everyone is that there would be no point to recreating this live in a certain sense. The essence of this record is as a recording. It's a piece of recorded art. And the songs are all about, you know, how could we best reflect this stuff on tape?
The conceit on the cover and in the record is, we're not the Beatles now, we're Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. We put on these funny costumes, we surround ourselves with, you know, all these icons from cultural history. And Tim Riley come out with what's been called the first concept album in the history of rock and roll. What does that mean?
Well, critics argue whether it's actually the first concept album in rock and roll, because there's a couple important precedents you have to talk about, which is Frank Zappa's Freak Out, for example, which is something the Beatles knew, a record the Beatles knew and were influenced by. And also Brian Wilson's Pet Sounds, I think you have to say. And
which they were aware of and paying a lot of attention to.
Keenly aware of and very intimidated by. And there's quotes from Paul McCartney saying, you know, what do we do now after Pet Sounds? How do we possibly top this? And he sets out really to sort of to write the Beatles' answer to Pet Sounds, which becomes Sgt. Pepper.
So, Tim Page, what do you hear in the aspirations here? I mean, where do these come from in the Beatles' roots, and what do you hear them reaching for in Sgt. Pepper?
Well, you hear them reaching towards a lot of different things.
I would argue that in some ways, Sgt. Pepper is not as successful as some of their earlier records, perhaps Rubber Soul or Revolver.
Mm-hmm. 65, 66. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I would even put Help in there. not the one that we knew in America, which had all this sort of like secret agent spy music filler in
right.
between, but the original one that came out in Britain. But what you have is you've got all sorts of different things. You've got Indian Raga in Within You, Without You. You've got, Good Hard Rock and Roll and Getting Better and some of the other cuts. And you've got Day in the Life, which is, of course, sort of an extraordinary creation. You have an ambition to be really... to kind of sum up a sonic world, and certainly that ambition was new. Whether it is the album which I would turn to immediately to if I wanted to play one Beatles record or take one to a desert island is another question, something which I'd be curious to hear my fellow panelists. You also have the sort of ricky-ticky vaudeville sense of When I'm 64, which is a charming song, but in retrospect, for me at least, it's kind of a warning of what was to come with Paul McCartney, all this sort of glutinous, addle-pated right. stuff like Honey Pie and Silly Love Songs.
And now he is 64, and the world is a different place, but it sure changed on that day. Tim Page, Tim Riley, Anthony DeCurtis, please stand by. We're talking about the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band at 40. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper at 40. There it was, suddenly, out of the blue, glorious, grandiose, a kind of a trumpet of cultural revolution, June 1st, 1967 in the UK, and the next day in the United States of America, turned a generation kind of on its head. When you listen today, what do you hear? What do you think? What would you say if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Were you there? Did you buy it, live it, and breathe it? And how does it sound? Now, what was the overwhelming magic of Sgt. Pepper? 800-423-8255 is our number. Anthony DeCurtis is with us from New York, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Tim Page, chief music critic at the Washington Post, is here. And Tim Riley, author of Tell Me Why, The Beatles. You can join us as well, 800-423-TALK. Were you there when it all came down? Susan's calling from New York City. Hi, Susan, you're on the air. What do you know?
Hey, Tom, I'm a Gen Xer. I was born in 68, so I have no reality without this album. I learned to read to the back cover, and that was always a part of my growing up. And what I find fascinating is I volunteer with a youth program, and they relate to the Beatles to now the way that they dealt with any other past artist.
How old are these kids?
15, 16, 17 years old.
And it still works for them, or does it sound
Absolutely.
Like something strange and musty?
We led a weekend conference on the Beatles that they asked for. There's no other band like that.
Why? So, what is it about it?
I think it's the four distinct personalities. I think that there's something that each of them can grasp onto. Paul remains the cute, cheerful one. John remains still the sullen, dark outsider with the great sense of humor. George is still the guy that you want to get to know if you're sensible enough to know that he's the good guy. Ringo is still the humorist. And you combine those four brilliant minds with those distinctive charismas, there's something that they can grasp onto.
That's amazing. But, after all these years, when they never even saw them walk around, but it's got to be the music itself, doesn't it?
Well, of course it's the music. But the music and the personalities are so fused. And it's the youth, the everlasting youth with the wisdom. There's something about speaking about sexuality, speaking about drugs that remains, but it's also speaking about enthusiasm, speaking about loneliness.
Yeah, no kidding. Youth plus wisdom, and you've got a great big cultural boom right there. Susan, thanks for that in New York. Let's go to San Francisco. And Dave, what do you hear? What do you remember?
Well, I was up at my 8th. I had just about to turn 30. It's now the 40th anniversary of the Summer of Love. And I remember rolling joints on the cover. But there's, of course, music everywhere out there on around 8th Street in the Haight-Ashbury. And so it seemed that suddenly things had gone worldwide, that from a trickle of people suddenly appearing in the Haight-Ashbury a few years before, a trickle had become a stream, had become a river, and then a mighty torrent. And then with the Beatles, it was Judas Priest. Where'd they all come from?
And it felt like magic, but what was it going to bring? What was supposed to come in train, Dave?
Well, it seemed like the whole world was in a transformation. A new generation was coming along. I was a little older. As I say, I was about to turn 30, and so my roots were in the Beat Generation. So I saw it go from a handful of people to what seemed to be a mass movement of what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding. And we seemed to be on the door. We had the free store. People were being fed out in the street.
It's great. We've got you. You're practically channeling Ginsberg there, Dave, and we love it. Thanks for that. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Jason, you're on the air, Jason.
Hi. I was in 9th grade and when that album came out, and we actually put on a performance with a light show and featured Sgt. Pepper's, which had just come out, and of course ended with Day in the Life. And for about, actually, I'm still in a band called Not the Beatles. We play all Beatles music.
Yeah.
And we used to play in Harvard Square like every month of the year, every weekend we could for about 4 years. And the response of people, literally from all over the world, all ages of people, was just phenomenal and helped me playing the music. I hear the music now, and I don't only see the Fab Four. It's like I see and hear the guys that I used to play with.
So
it's remarkable.
Right, it's their show, and it's your show, too. Jason, thanks for that. Anthony DeCurtis, you've talked not so long ago with Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. What were their memories? What do they say about this album?
Well, it's obviously a big favorite for Paul McCartney. I mean, there are moments in interviews, you know, when you know that that person is right back in that emotional space. And when we were discussing The Summer of Love and Sgt. Pepper, I mean, McCartney just went there. You know, the kind of sense of immediacy and excitement, I think, that he felt as, you know, maybe the primary architect of that project was palpable. And I think that it's very interesting, you know. I mean, if you take the Beatles' career, you know, and in many ways it traces the arc of the 60s, you know, this kind of inchoate, tremendous enthusiasm at the beginning, and then, you know, ending in recrimination and bitterness and lots of kind of shattered and hurt feelings and disappointment. But, you know, Sgt. Pepper, I think, looms as a kind of high point. And this is not to discredit, again, the statement that Tim Page made. You know, I'm much more likely to listen to Rubber Soul or Revolver or Help, actually, which is a terrific record. But, you know, Sgt. Pepper is, in a way, more important than the music. It's an album that is more important than its music. It's kind of symbolic quality. You know, kind of represents a 60s high point where all of whatever the hopes of are when people mention the 60s, Sgt. Pepper is it. You know, that's the soundtrack to The Summer of Love. I mean, that was it.
And you describe Paul McCartney recalling how suddenly, it was everywhere. Jimi Hendrix was playing at the Savile Theater in the West End of London, and he opened it up with Sgt. Pepper on the Hendrix guitar.
Yeah, oh, that kind of thing, you know. I mean, that must have happened. I mean, that kind of thing probably happened everywhere. You know, McCartney and Harrison happened to be in the audience, but it just kind of seemed that it had just suffused, you know, the entire culture instantaneously.
Instantaneously. Let's go to Chicago. And Bob, hi, Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was, I can remember like it was yesterday picking that album up. I'm a musician, and I was 14 years old, and I think what I remember more than anything was how on earth am I ever going to be able to remotely match that magic that those guys had. But it stayed with me, and I stayed a musician. And I don't know if there was anything more influential that caused me to stay there than the Sgt. Pepper's album.
So the Bob in Chicago is sealed right in there by Sgt. Pepper. Let's go to Los Angeles. And Charlie, you're on the air.
Hey, hello. Yes, I was a 17-year-old kid. I ran out to buy the Sgt. Pepper album the first day. I had also gotten the Butcher Block album just before that. I'd been totally hooked by Rubber Soul. And I sat with my parents in our suburban house in, Mar Vista, telling my parents and my brother that this is probably the most important album of all time. I think that was maybe a little overstated, but it did have a tremendous effect on me. So.
And everybody else was feeling it at the same time, it seemed. Charlie in L.A., thanks for calling. Tim Riley, what about the individual Beatles and how they related to this album? Paul McCartney's role, John Lennon. I mean, we're also told that the seeds of their ultimate splitting up are planted inside this album.
Right. Well, it's one of the records. It's at the midpoint of their career, and you can really hear these two key songwriters occupying very different emotional space and writing from very different points of view. Which, of course, we now trace in retrospect. It's much, much more clear. You can see that starting to happen earlier. But on this record, there really are very distinctive Paul songs and very distinctive John songs. And then The Day in the Life, the last song, they literally stitch those two sensibilities together. So you get a Paul song inside a John song, at where Paul is kind of waking up from John Lennon's hallucination or something. And, it's the kind of thing that... Only the very best songwriters could pull off, because it sounds like it shouldn't work, but it works just beautifully. And so you do get a picture of these two very different songwriters alive and at work in the same band, and you begin to get this idea, my goodness, how can they stay in this band together? They're very far apart, even though they're still putting both their names on the songs they're writing.
And then, of course, you get George Harrison and Ringo, each with one of their own. George Harrison off on his magical mystery sort of Eastern tour. The sitar makes its appearance in popular culture here with Within You, Without You. Let's listen for a moment. Tim Page, it wasn't long before people were saying, play it backwards and the devil's speaking, but was there a deliberate message from the Beatles to the world here? They were very aware of their cultural clout. What were they telling the planet?
Well, I don't know. It's hard for me to necessarily codify it in one message. I will say that the song you're playing right now was the one which seemed to me at the time, and I was 12, to be the really truly psychedelic song. I mean, this drone, this very, very unfamiliar Eastern sound. I mean, yes, sitar had been used on Norwegian Wood and on a couple of other things, yep. But you suddenly have this drone and this kind of mantra quality. I just remember listening to this, and I always found this, certainly at that point, the most radical and strange piece on the album. One other thing that should be mentioned real quickly is this song began side two of Sgt. Pepper. Mm-hmm. We now think of CDs as these unbroken
front
things.
Front to back,
but, but in those days you had to turn it over, and you went directly from Benefit of Mr. Kite into this, bizarre new world. It was very impressive, and I think it's important when we listen to recordings from this era, especially ones that are more than just collections of songs, to remember where the side break was.
No kidding. And you turned it over, and it was a whole new world, sort of world music beginning to bust out right there.
Yep.
Sam's calling from Boston. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing? Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Back in the summer of '67, I can so clearly remember sitting on my cousin's porch and that record being put on, and we all just sat there, guys, girls, and there was this realization, something has changed, something big has changed here. Now, I was in just before my senior year at Syracuse and 9 months before becoming program director at one of the four first progressive rock stations in the United States.
Yeah.
Here in Boston.
So you were tuned in.
And I'll tell you, that record not only had the impact that we're all talking about this morning on music and on culture, but frankly, it was a key element in the beginning of FM rock radio.
Why this one in particular? Because it opened up a whole new world that made you want to listen in a new way, on a new wavelength?
Absolutely. I mean, previous Top 40 radio had been so superficial and so reticent to experiment, shall we say. I mean, I remember one major Boston AM rocker at that time promoting for about half a day that they were going to play the long version of Light My Fire. I mean, good Lord. Yeah, what was going on in the dormitories and the apartments in Boston and all over the United States. We were, you know, all sharing music constantly. And, you know, one track was very different from the next. It was about listening, as has been said. And unfortunately, I think a lot of that's gone away in commercial music radio again.
And suddenly you needed the long form and maybe FM to go with it. Sam, thanks for that recollection. Let's get another call from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Judith, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think I have a different take because I think the early 60s were a time of enormous promise in civil rights, in anti-war and peace movements. And I think Sgt. Pepper, not that it caused it, but it was one of those times when celebrities really turned inward, and instead of really leading, they led us off in the wrong direction. I mean, I think that the turn toward drugs and toward self-centeredness and toward consumerism also led a lot of white kids away from their natural allies, the black kids. I mean, I really think this is a white thing, and it was a time when there was a real chance for unity, a real chance to move forward. So
when you hear that sitar music and George Harrison floating away to Mahavishnu and all that, what, that's the toke up and drop out moment to you?
Well, I love the music, but I hate what happened. And I think that the Beatles really did, you know, turn in a direction that wasn't helpful. I mean, it's beautiful music, but there were things that could have been accomplished, and we turned to a youth movement that really was sort of sad. And I,
interesting, yeah.
That is my recollection. You know, I was in the middle of it too.
Yeah, Judith, I'm glad you share it. Tony DeCurtis, what about it? There's the sort of turn, not the exemplify the 60s, but the turn away from the root of the 60s, as Judith remembers.
Well, you know, in a certain sense, I mean, you could certainly, and people have, you know, make a, and your caller just did, I think, you know, make a political critique of what this represented, you know, because there was a sense, you know, consciousness is going to change everything, you know. Mm-hmm. We're smoking pot now, you know. Mm-hmm. We're wearing colorful clothes, you know, we feel good. Yeah, everybody likes each other, you know. You know, maybe we're taking LSD too, and all of the changes are going to follow that. It wasn't necessarily a moment, certainly for white people, you know, where everyone was thinking about, you know, organizing. And that was going on too. But in a sense, you know, I think your caller, you know, had a point that there was a, you know, if you, you know, you take the Marxist line, you know, consciousness follows material circumstances. Mm. You know, you change the world and then your thinking changes. Mm. This was the, Sgt. Pepper sort of represents the opposite. We change our consciousness and then the world changes. And, you know,
yep.
The first usage is the one that tends to make for political change, I think.
But there's the big statement here, change the consciousness and certainly change the music. Anthony DeCurtis at Rolling Stone, Tim Page with the Washington Post, and Tim Riley with me in the studio. Please stand by. We're talking about the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band at 40. Here's Fixing a Hole, Paul McCartney's. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Yesterday, and I still come. Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress at Rite Aid GNC and Duane Reade. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles. 617-859-0540.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at and listening to Sgt. Pepper at 40.
Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends.
1967, the Beatles went off the tour circuit into the studio and came out with a cultural revolution. You can join the conversation this hour. Do you remember when the Fab Four went groovy, psychedelic, cosmic? And what's the heart and soul of Sgt. Pepper now, 40 years on? How do you hear it? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Tim Riley is with us in the studio, author of Tell Me Why, The Beatles. Tim Page is with us from the Washington Post, lifelong Beatles fan, Pulitzer Prize winner, chief music critic for the Washington Post. And from Rolling Stone, Anthony DeCurtis is here, author of In Other Words, Artists Talk About Life and Other Matters. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Tim Riley, tell us about the making of this album. They went into the studio and did what that hadn't exactly been done?
Well, they did so many things. They made it on 2 4-track tape recorders, and everyone was working, was just graduating onto 4-track.
4-track. I mean, right. Now we have 100 or hundreds. I don't know, but with 4-tracks, they made all that sound.
With digital now, we have an infinite number of tracks, basically. With 4-tracks, they said, well, there's too much going on here in these songs. We can't even get it on 1 4-track. So we're going to work, basically, they took 2 4-track machines and created an 8-track studio by bouncing all the tracks down,
right,
and then saving tracks up top for more room for ever more and more instruments. And they really wanted to create a lot of eccentric new colors, new sounds. So the opening of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, for example, is a mellotron that is sampled to sound somewhere between a harpsichord and a synthesizer. It's definitely a keyboard, but it really was meant to be a brand new sound. They wanted to have a kind of keyboard that would be, what is that? Nobody could figure out what it was. Mm. And this was one of the things they were chasing. They had enough leverage and enough clout at this point to say, we're a rock band and we've been as successful as we can be as a rock band, but let's add as many new sounds and as new variants to the rock and roll sound as we possibly can. And of course that meant the all sitar. I mean, the thing about Within Without You is that it has no rock band. It is the first sitar based completely Indian instrument arrangement the Beatles did. And then of course they bring in an orchestra for A Day in the Life, and they want to use the rock band, they want to use Eastern instruments, they want to use an orchestra, they want to reach as wide and broad a range of styles as they possibly can.
Tim Page, everything new comes from somewhere. What were they drawing on from the past when they put Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band together, or does this look just like a creation straight out of the brains of 4 fired up Fab Four guys?
No, I think it's got a lot of precursors. I think you've certainly got the English music hall, you've got the Indian music, the rock and roll, the just good solid pop melodies. It's funny because I remember She's Leaving Home when it came out. I don't remember whether it was Ned Roram who compared it to Schubert, it's a very, it's a very romantic, very traditional song, and it was a song that I think, certainly one of the songs that a lot of us who were kids then would play first to our parents to try to convince them that there was real music going on here, to make them think that this was not just a bunch of, thrashing maniacs behind bass and drums. Now,
Tim, hold the thought right there. We'll listen to just a little bit of that one, She's Leaving Home, from Sgt. Pepper.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock,
as the day begins. Silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more. She goes downstairs to the kitchen, clutching her handkerchief.
Anthony DeCurtis, anything but a thrashing bass there. I mean, this, what did rock and roll make of this? This presented as part of a rock and roll album.
Well, this is part of, I think, you know, considering the record as a whole, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, Tim mentioned Music Hall, you know, and that's something like When I'm 64, which, you know, maybe did press age, you know, certain aspects of McCartney's songwriting and sensibility to come. But I think that he was pulling that straight out of, you know, a kind of interest in, you know, the songs that his parents and grandparents sang, which seemed quaint at that time. There was, I think, a desire on the part of almost anything that happened. I mean, if anybody was around in the 60s, it was a pretty ahistorical time in a certain way, you know, and that anything that preceded it kind of seemed quaint or mm-hmm. somehow, you know, irrelevant to what was going on right at the moment. So you could reach back to a form like that, you know, vaguely to ironize it, to have some fun with it, to sort of evoke a simpler world, you know, while you were on your way to, you know, the shore that Lennon was talking about in Lizzie in the Sky with Diamonds.
Right.
So something like She's Leaving Home, also, I think, you know, you want to remember the lyrics. I mean, it seemed like a kind of call to, you know, she's leaving home, she's going to Haight-Ashbury, she's going to the East Village, you know. There was that sense of the song being a kind of endorsement of, you know, what really, it's kind of poignant, but what do your parents or an older generation have to say to you finally?
Mm.
You know, you have to go out and find your own way.
And Tim Riley, here we had an album with all the lyrics included, as I understand, for the first time.
Yeah, for the first time. I mean, the thing about She's Leaving Home, it's one of the reasons that the record as a whole transcends its era as well as it does. If you think about it, She's Leaving Home is one of the very few topical songs. And what Tony was talking about with, you know, it does kind of reflect this. There were a lot of runaways. This was happening in culture at the time. Mm-hmm. But the Beatles do this very interesting thing. The song is really reflecting the parents' point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story arc of the girl who's leaving home to meet up with a man from the motor trade, that's very pedestrian. That's hackneyed. But the poignancy all comes from the parents saying, what did we do that was wrong? We didn't know it was wrong.
Right.
They're bereft. They're lonely. They're left behind. And that was a really, that's a radical point of view from within the 60s, from the most subversive rock and roll band of the time to be adopting the parents' point of view. But it's also one of the key ways in which Sgt. Pepper is of its time, but it's not limited to its time.
Tim Page, turn it forward then. This opened up with its incredible reception and popularity. Years and years of people kind of drawing on this concept album idea. What did it lead to?
Well, it led in a lot of directions, not all of them necessarily that healthy, but it did lead to, it led to a lot of very grandiose, very very much highly produced albums, some of them gorgeous, of course, others of them, you know, the sort of thing that Spinal Tap made fun of, you know, when they have somebody talking about how he's writing a trilogy.
But is this Tommy's Taproot?
Sure.
Is this Andrew Lloyd Webber's?
To use two very, very different examples. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing I'd also say about the song is it's hard for people to remember now, but there was a time where if you just wanted to go anywhere, you'd go out and you'd stick out your thumb. I can remember the Massachusetts Turnpike, and at every exit there'd be kids,
yeah,
sometimes 40, 50 of them, either with signs saying to Boston or saying to Tanglewood, or, you know, it was
all
a very
free,
mobile
into the world.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Let's take a call from Brett in Brighton, Massachusetts. Brett, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that the hallmark of really great music is that one of your hosts said, that it transcends the time that it's in. And over this past weekend at the Brookline Music School, we had actually, we did it at Northeastern. We did Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album from start to finish at Northeastern.
How the heck do you do that? Just around the corner from us, but what, with a symphony orchestra? With a...
Well, it was an we had a 30-piece orchestra made up of mainly our students, which are, you know,
what ages, Brett?
Fourth grade, yeah. And fourth grade through high school. 13 different rhythm sections, 15 vocalists, wow. A lot of them high school students, and they got this music. I mean, they, even the ones that had never heard it before, by the end of the rehearsal process and by the time we were on stage doing it, they were mouthing the words when they were in the orchestra. When they weren't playing their parts, they were mouthing the words.
And why? What is it about it? Why were those 9-year-old fourth graders in 2007, 40 years later, why do you think they get it, got it?
Because the structure of the songs is so strong. I mean, they're so strongly musically put together that it's just like the way Bach, if you play Bach now, it still sounds like it's relevant to now. That music still sounds like it's relevant to now because it's so well crafted. And I think those kids will, you know, they weren't going to be born for another 20, 30 years, but they will remember Sgt. Pepper as being something that happened in May of 2007. And that's a beautiful thing about well-written music.
That's incredible. And that was music made practically yesterday. I want to go to what all of you, Tony and Tim Riley, Tim Page, have talked about as maybe the most interesting thing here, a day in the life, this kind of collaboration, but also demonstration of tension between the McCartney and Lennon legs of the Beatle life. Let's listen to a little bit of A Day in the Life from Sgt. Pepper. Nobody was really sure he was from the House of Lords. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away, but I just had to look, having read the book. I'd love to turn you. Wow. Tim Riley, from that cosmic wind-up to the little tinkle of the alarm clock, and we are all over the place there. What's going on?
Well, it's one of the great things about Pepper is that it really is an alternative world where you're seduced into this great escapist fantasy of color and psychedelia and, you know, inspired by hallucinogenics. But at the end of the record, they say, the show's come to a close, we're leaving now, we'd like to take you home with us, we like you so much, but we can't, it's a record, it's ending. And it fades down into this final song. And the final song, A Day in the Life, really takes us back to the real world. And it really lifts the entirety of Pepper out of the ordinary and into the poetic. Because one of the things they're saying, which I think is still relevant today, is, okay, if pop is this great escapist fantasy, then what do we do when we get back home? How do we look
at
the real world?
When the alarm clock rings.
Right? Are we different? Can pop help us deal with the real world? And I think part of what they're saying is, maybe, maybe not, but they definitely, it's a very tragic ending to a record that is basically uplift. And it comes to a big crashing chord of a finale that is very unsettling. And the exclamation point at the end of this record, that giant E major chord, it's very declamatory, but they let it hang in the air. Mm. And the longer it hangs in the air, the more unsettling it becomes. It is not a happy ending to this song and
this
record.
Is. Tony DeCurtis all these years later, where does it leave you on that joy and tragedy spectrum of thought, emotion?
Well, you know, I think the question that you asked earlier, what is the message? I think the message is right in that song. You know, I'd love to turn you on. I mean, I think that there's that sense of, you know, that idea of consciousness will change the world, you know, and that psychedelics are taking us to that place. And I think that moment of McCartney waking up in the real world, and he's hurrying and he's rushing, and then suddenly, you know, and everything just seems banal, you know, 4,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. The English army had just won the world. That's the old world. It doesn't matter anymore. All this hurry and bustling doesn't matter anymore. What matters is this dream we're having, and that's what we go out on. And I think that was finally, you know, I think that was a widely felt notion at the time. And certainly, you know, the Beatles popularized it. It's kind of not fashionable to, I guess, make statements about, you know, a record in a certain way endorsing the use of psychedelic drugs. But, you know, it's pretty unmistakable, it seems to me.
And Tim Page, you were there in all the excitement of youth buying it, with people of all ages and stripes around you buying it in June of 1967. When you listen back now, you know, does it fill you with nostalgia? Does it make you want to move on? That didn't work, thank you. Or bring it back because it's so beautiful, I want to hear it again.
Well, I'm still very fond of it. What interests me, though, is I've got a 20-year-old son, and he's listening to all the same music that I used to listen to, as well as a lot of music which hadn't been made yet. And it's so interesting to find out what he likes and what he doesn't like, and the different takes that he has on the music that I cared for at his age or even younger. And it's fascinating because there's often the same sort of fondness, but they're hearing it with very different ears. And I would think that anybody who hears Sgt. Pepper now will still recognize that it's a remarkably crafted work of art. But it's, you know, Sgt. Pepper in 2007 isn't Sgt. Pepper in 1967. And it's... you know, that's just the way art and time work.
But it's still a lot of fun to listen to, and it takes our imaginations on a big trip. You all are so generous and wonderful to spend this hour with us, and what fun. Tim Page at the Washington Post, great to have you. Thank you for being with us this hour.
Terrific.
Anthony DeCurtis at Rolling Stone, wonderful work. Thanks so much for being here, Anthony.
Oh, I had a great time.
And Tim Riley, author of Tell Me Why, The Beatles Album by Album. Tim, great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
We go out with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band one more time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.